centaur pursuing a naked woman, some long-handled spoons, a piperatorium, or pepper pot, which might actually have been used to store expensive spices, a scattering of coins, a statuette of a tiger, or some similar creature, two bracelets. Chubb knew exactly what he was looking at. This was the treasure trove that had been stolen from Sir Magnus Pye. Every item had been described by him when he had called in the police. But why had someone stolen the treasure simply to discard it? He understood now that they must have dropped one piece, the belt buckle that Brent had found, as they made their way across the lawn. They had then reached the edge of the lake and thrown the rest in. Had they been surprised while they were trying to make their getaway? Could they have planned to have come back and retrieved the loot another time? It made no sense. "I think that's it," one of the divers called out. Chubb looked down at the separate pieces, all of it silver. So much silver, glinting in the evening sun. Part 6. Gold. Chapter 1. The house was close to Caedlin Park in Cardiff, backing onto the railway line that ran from Whitchurch to Rubina. It was in the middle of a short terrace, three identical houses on either side, all of them tired, in need of cheering up. Seven gates, seven square gardens full of dusty plants, struggling to survive. Seven front doors, seven chimney stacks. They were somehow interchangeable, but the green Austin A40, with its registration number FPJ247, parked outside the middle one, told Punt immediately where to go. A man was waiting for them. From the way he was standing there, he could have been waiting all his life. As they pulled in, he raised a hand, not so much in welcome as in acknowledgement that they had arrived. He was in his late 50s, but looked much older, worn out by a struggle that he had actually lost a long time ago. He had thinning hair, an untidy moustache, and sullen, dark brown eyes. He was wearing clothes that were much too warm for the summer afternoon, and which needed a wash. Fraser had never seen anyone who looked more alone. "Mr. Pund?" he asked, as they got out of the car. "It is a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Blakiston. Please, come in." He led them into a dark, narrow hallway with a kitchen at the far end. From here, they could look out over a half-neglected garden that sloped up steeply to the railway line at the end. The house was clean, but charmless. There was nothing very personal, no family photographs, no letters on the hall table, no sign that anyone else lived here. Very little sunlight made its way in. It had that in common with the lodge house in Saxby-on-Avon. Everything was hemmed in by shadow. "I always knew the police would want to speak to me," he said. "Will you have some tea?" He put the kettle on the hob and managed to start a flame with a third click of the switch. "We are not, strictly speaking, the police," Punt told him. "No, but you're investigating the deaths. Your wife and Sir Magnus Pye." "Yes." Blakiston nodded, then ran a hand over his chin. He had shaved that morning, but with a razor he had used too many times. Hair was sprouting in the cleft underneath his lip, and there was a small cut on his chin. "I did think about calling someone," he said. "I was there, you know, on the night he died. But then I thought, why bother? I didn't see anything. I don't know anything. It's got nothing to do with me."
"That may not be the case at all, Mr. Blakiston. I have been looking forward to meeting you."
"Well, I hope you won't be disappointed." He emptied the teapot, which was still full of old leaves, washed it out with boiling water, and added new ones. He took a bottle of milk out of a fridge that had little else inside. At the bottom of the garden, a train rumbled past, billowing steam, and for a moment the air was filled with the smell of cinders. He didn't seem to notice. He finished making the tea and brought it to the table. The three of them sat down.
Well?
You know why we are here, Mr. Blakiston, Punt said. Why don't you tell us your story? Begin from the beginning. Leave nothing out.
Blakiston nodded.
He poured the tea. Then he began to talk. He was 58 years old. He had been living in Cardiff ever since he had left Saxby-on-Avon 12 years ago. He'd had family here, an uncle who owned an electrical shop not far away on the Eastern Road. The uncle was dead now, but he had inherited the shop, and it provided a living, at least for the sort of life he led. He was on his own. Fraser had been right about that.
I never actually divorced Mary, he said. I don't know why not. After what happened with Tom, there was no way the two of us were going to stay together, but at the same time, neither of us was ever going to get married again, so what was the point? She wasn't interested in lawyers and all that stuff. I suppose that makes me officially her widower.
You never saw her again after you left? Punt asked.
We stayed in touch. We wrote to each other, and I called her now and then, to ask her about Robert and to see if there was anything she needed. But if she'd needed anything, she would never have asked me.
Punt took out his Sobranis. It was unusual for him to smoke when he was working on a case, but nothing about the detective had been quite the same recently, and Fraser had been desperately worried since he had been taken ill in Dr. Redwing's surgery. Punt had refused to say anything about it. In the car, on the way here, he had barely spoken at all.
Let us go back to the time when you and Mary met, Punt suggested. Tell me about your time at Shepherd's Farm.
That was my dad's place, Blakiston said. He got it from his dad, and it had been in the family for as long as anyone can remember. I come from a long line of farmers, but I never really took to it. My dad used to say I was the black sheep, which was funny, because that's what we had, a couple of 100 acres and lots of sheep. I feel sorry for him, looking back on it. I was his only child, and I just wasn't interested, so that was that. I'd always been good at maths and science at school, and I had ideas about going to America and becoming a rocket engineer, which is a bit of a laugh, because I worked for 20 years as a mechanic, and I never got any further than Wales. But that's how it is when you're a kid, isn't it? You have all these dreams, and unless you're lucky, they never amount to anything. Still, I can't complain. We all lived there happily enough. Even Mary liked it to begin with.
In what circumstances did you meet your wife? Punt asked.
She lived in Torbury, which was about 5 miles away. Her mother and my mother were at school together. She came over for lunch one Sunday with her parents, and that's how we met. Mary was in her 20s then, and as pretty as you can imagine. I fell for her the moment I saw her, and we were married within a year.
And what, I wonder, did your parents make of her?
They liked her well enough. In fact, there was a time when I would say everything was pretty much perfect. We had 2 sons, Robert first, then Tom. They grew up on the land, and I can still see them racing around, helping my dad when they got back from school. I think we were probably happier there than we ever were anywhere else. But it couldn't last. My dad was up to his eyes in debt, and I wasn't helping him. I got a job at Whitchurch Airport, which was 1.5 hours away near Bristol. This was the end of the '30s. I was doing routine maintenance on planes for the Civil Air Guard, and I met a lot of the young pilots coming in for training. I knew there was a war on the way, but in a place like Saxby-on-Avon, it was easy to forget it. Mary was doing jobs in and around the village. We were already going our separate ways. That's why she blamed me for what happened. And maybe she was right.
Tell me about your children, Punt said.
I love those boys. Believe me, there isn't a day when I don't think about what happened. He choked on his words and had to pause for a moment to recover.
I don't know how it all went so wrong, Mr. Pund. I really don't. When we were up at Shepherd's Farm, I won't say it was perfect, but we used to have fun. They could be right little sods, always fighting, always at each other's throats. But that's true of any boys, isn't it? He gazed at Punt as if needing affirmation, and when none came, he went on. They could be close, too. The best of friends. Robert was the quiet one. You always got the impression that he was thinking about something. Even when he was quite young, he used to take himself off for long walks along the Bath Valley, and there were times we'd get quite worried about him. Tom was more of a live wire. He saw himself as a bit of an inventor. He was always mixing potions and putting things together from the insides of old machines. I suppose he might have got that from me. And I'll admit, he was the one I used to spoil. Robert was closer to his mother. It was a difficult birth. She nearly lost him. And when he was a baby, he had all sorts of illnesses. The village doctor, a chap called Renard, was always in and out of the house. If you ask me, that's what made her so overprotective. There were times when she wouldn't let me come near him. Tom was the easier boy. I was closer to him. Always. Him and me. He took out a packet of 10 cigarettes, tore off the cellophane, and lit one. Everything went wrong when we left the farm, he said, and suddenly he was bitter. The day that man came into our life, that's when it began, Sir Magnus Bloody Pie. It's easy enough to see it now, and I wonder how I could have been so blind, so stupid. But at the time, what he was offering seemed an answer to our prayers. A regular salary for Mary, somewhere to live, nice grounds for the boys to run around in. At least that's how Mary saw it, and that's how she sold it to me. You argued? I tried not to argue with her. All it did was turn her against me. I said I had a couple of misgivings, that's all. I didn't like the idea of her being a housekeeper. I thought she was better than that. And I remember warning her that once we were there, we'd be trapped. It would be like he owned us. But the thing was, you see, we didn't really have any choice. We didn't have any savings. It was the best offer we were going to get. And at first it was fine. Pye Hall was nice enough, and I got on well enough with Stanley Brent, who was the groundsman there, with his son. We weren't paying any rent, and in some ways it was better to be on our own as a family, without my mum and dad around all the time. But there was something about the lodge house that rubbed us up the wrong way. It was dark all the year round, and it never really felt like home. We all started getting on each other's nerves, even the boys. Mary and I seemed to be sniping at each other all the time. I hated the way she looked up to Sir Magnus just because he had a title and so much money. He was no better than me. He'd never done a proper day's work in his life. He only had Pye Hall because he'd inherited it. But she couldn't see that. She thought it made her special in some way. What she didn't understand was that when you're cleaning a toilet, you're still cleaning a toilet. And what difference does it make if some aristocratic bum is going to sit on it? I said that to her once, and she was furious. But the way she saw herself, she wasn't a cleaner or a housekeeper. She was the lady of the manor. Magnus had one son of his own, Freddy, but he was still very young, and he was quite surly. There was no real love there. So his lordship started interesting himself in my boys instead. He used to encourage them to play on his land and spoil them with little gifts, threepence here, sixpence there, and he'd get them to play practical jokes on Neville Brent. His parents were dead by then. They'd been killed in a car accident, and Neville had taken over working on the estate. If you ask me, there was something queer about him. I don't think he was quite right in the head. But that didn't stop them spying on him, teasing him, throwing snowballs, that sort of thing. It was cruel. I wish they hadn't done it. You couldn't stop them? I couldn't do anything, Mr. Punt. How can I make you understand? They never listened to me. I wasn't their father anymore. Almost from the day we moved into that place, I found myself being pushed to one side. Magnus, Magnus. That was all anyone ever talked about. When the boys got their school reports, nobody cared what I thought. You know what? Mary would get the boys to take them up to the main house and show them to him, as if his opinion mattered more than mine. It got worse and worse over time, Mr. Pund. I began to loathe that man. He always had a way of making me feel small, reminding me that I was living in his house on his land, as if I'd ever wanted to be there in the first place. And it was his fault what happened, I swear to you. He killed my son as if he did it with his own hands, and at that same moment he ruined me. Tom was the light of my life, and when he went there was nothing left for me. He fell silent and wiped his eye with the back of his hand. Look at me. Look at this place. I often ask myself what I did to deserve it. I never hurt anyone, and I end up here. I sometimes think I've been punished for something I didn't do. I am sure you are blameless. I am blameless. I did nothing wrong. What happened had nothing to do with me. He stopped, fixing his eyes on Punt and Fraser, daring them to disagree. It was Magnus Pye. Bloody Magnus Pye. He took a breath, then went on. The war had started, and I'd been sent off to Boscombe Down, working mainly on Hawker Hurricanes. I was away from home, and I didn't really know what was going on, and when I came back occasional weekends, it was like I was a stranger. Mary had changed so much. She was never pleased to see me. She was secretive, like she was hiding something. It was hard to believe she was the same girl I'd met and married and been with at Shepherd's Farm. Robert didn't want to have too much to do with me either. He was his mother's child. If it hadn't been for Tom, it would hardly have been worth showing up. Anyway, Sir Magnus was there in my place. I told you about games. There was this game he played with the boys, with my boys. They were obsessed with buried treasure. Well, all boys like that sort of thing. But I'm sure you know the Pies had dug up a whole load of stuff, Roman coins and the rest of it, in Dingle Dell. He had them on display in his house. And so it was easy for him to turn the two of them into treasure hunters. He'd take chocolate bars wrapped in foil, or sometimes sixpenny pieces, or half crowns, and he'd hide them all over the estate. Then he'd give them clues and set them off. They might spend the whole day doing that, and you couldn't really complain because it got them out in the open air. It was good for them, wasn't it? It was fun. But he wasn't their father. He didn't know what he was doing. And one day he took it too far. He had a piece of gold. Not real gold. Iron pyrites, what they call fool's gold. He had a big lump of it, and he decided to make that the prize. Of course, Tom and Robert didn't know the difference. They thought it was the real thing, and they were desperate to get their hands on it. And do you know where he put it, the bloody fool? He hid it in a clump of bulrushes, right on the edge of the lake. He led them to the water's edge. 14 years old and 12 years old. He led them there as surely as if he'd put up a sign. This is what happened. The two boys had separated. Robert was in Dingle Dell, searching in the trees. Tom went down to the water. Maybe he saw the gold glinting in the sun, or maybe he'd worked out one of the clues. He didn't even need to get his feet wet, but he was so excited, he decided to wade in. And what then? Maybe he stumbled. There are a lot of weeds, and they could have wrapped themselves around his legs. Here's what I know. Just after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Brent comes along with the lawnmower, and he sees my boy lying face down in the water. Matthew Blakiston's voice cracked. Tom had drowned. Brent did what he could. Tom was only a few feet out from the shore, and Brent dragged him back to dry land. Then Robert came out of the wood and saw what was happening. He plunged into the water. He was screaming. He waded over to them and shouted at Brent to get help. Brent didn't know what to do, but Robert had learned basic first aid at school and tried to save his brother with mouth to mouth. It was too late. Tom was dead. I only heard about all this later from the police. They'd talked to everyone involved, Sir Magnus, Brent, Mary, and Robert. Can you imagine how I felt, Mr. Punt? I was their father. But I hadn't been there. Matthew Blakiston bowed his head. His fist, with the cigarette, was clenched against his head, and smoke curled upwards as he sat there, silent. At that moment, Fraser was utterly aware of the smallness of the room, the hopelessness of a life broken. It occurred to him that Blakiston was an outcast. He was in exile from himself. "Do you want some more tea?" Blakiston asked suddenly. "I'll do it," Fraser said. Nobody wanted tea, but they needed time, a pause before he could go on. Fraser went over to the kettle. He was glad to break away. "I went back to Boscombe Down," he began again, once the fresh cups had been brought. "And the next time I came home, I knew exactly which way the wind was blowing. Mary and Robert had pulled up the drawbridge. She never let go of him after that, not for a minute. And it was like they didn't want to know me. I would have done my bit for my family, Mr. Punt. I swear I would have. But they never let me. Robert always said that I walked out on them, but that isn't true. I came home, but there was nobody there." "When was the last time you saw your son, Mr. Blakiston?" "Saturday, the 23rd of July. At his mother's funeral." "Did he see you?" "No." Blakiston took a deep breath. He had finished his cigarette and stubbed it out. "They say that when you lose a child, it brings you closer together or tears you apart. What most hurt me about Mary was that after Tom went, she never let me get close to Robert. She was protecting him from me. Can you believe that? It wasn't enough that I had lost one son. I ended up losing two. And part of me never stopped loving her. That's the pathetic thing. I told you I used to write to her on her birthday, at Christmas. I talked to her on the phone sometimes. At least she'd let me do that. But she didn't want me anywhere near. She made that clear enough." "Did you speak to her recently?" "The last time I spoke to her was a couple of months ago, but here's something you won't believe. I actually called her the day she died. It was the weirdest thing. I was woken up that morning by a bird in a tree, and it was making this horrible noise, this cawing. It was a magpie. One for sorrow. Do you know that old song? Well, I looked at it on the other side of the bedroom window, black and white, an evil little thing with its glinting eye, and suddenly I felt sick to the stomach. It was like I'd had a premonition. I knew something bad was going to happen. I went to the shop, but I couldn't work, and no one came in anyway. I was thinking about Mary. I was convinced something was going to happen to her, and in the end, I couldn't stop myself. I rang her. I tried her at the lodge, and then at the main house. But she didn't answer, because I was too late. She was already dead." He was playing with the cellophane from the cigarette packet, pulling it apart between his fingers. "I heard about her death a few days later. There was a piece in the newspaper. Would you believe it? Nobody even bothered to ring me. You'd have thought Robert might have got in touch, but he didn't care. Anyway, I knew I had to go to the funeral. It didn't matter what had happened. There'd been a time when the two of us were young and we'd been together. I wasn't going to let her go without saying goodbye. I'll admit I was nervous about showing my face. I didn't want to make a big thing of it with everyone crowding around, so I arrived late, and I wore a hat pulled down over my face. I'm a lot thinner than I used to be, and I'm nearly 60 years old. I thought if I kept well clear of Robert, I'd be all right. And that was how it turned out. I did see him there. He was standing with a girl, and I was glad to see that. It's just what he needs. He was always very solitary when he was a boy, and she looked a pretty little thing. I hear they're going to get married, and maybe if they have children, they'll let me visit them. People change in time, don't they? He says I wasn't there for him, but maybe if you see him, you'll tell him the truth. It was so strange to be there back in the village. I'm not even sure I like the place anymore. And seeing them all again, Dr. Redwing and Clarissa and Brent and all the others, it gave me a shiver, I can tell you. I noticed Sir Magnus and Lady Pye didn't show up, and that made me smile. I'm sure Mary would have been disappointed. I always did tell her he was no good. But perhaps it was just as well that he wasn't there. I'm not sure what I'd have done if I'd seen him that day. I blame him for what happened, Mr. Punt. Mary fell down the stairs while she was skivvying for him, so that makes two of them, Mary and Tom. They'd both be alive if it weren't for him. Is that why you went to his house 5 days later? Blakiston bowed his head. How did you know I was there? Your car was seen. Well, I'm not going to deny it. Yes, it was stupid of me, but at the end of the week, I went back. The thing is, I couldn't get it out of my head. First Tom, then Mary, both of them at Pye Hall. Listening to me now, you probably think I'm owning up to it, that I went back to kill him. But it wasn't like that. I just wanted to talk to him, to ask him about Mary. Everyone else who'd gone to that funeral, they'd had someone to talk to, but not me. No one even recognized me at my own wife's funeral. Was it so unreasonable to want to see him just for 5 minutes, just to ask him about Mary? He thought for a moment, then came to a decision. There was something else. You'll think the worse of me for it, but I was thinking about money. Not for me. For my son. When someone dies in the workplace, it's your responsibility. Mary had been working for Sir Magnus for more than 20 years, and he owed her a duty of care. I thought he might have come to some arrangement with her, you know, a pension. I knew Robert would never accept any financial help from me, even if I could have afforded it. But if he was about to get married, didn't he deserve some sort of start in life? Sir Magnus had always had a soft spot for him. I had this idea that I could ask him for help on Robert's behalf. He stopped and looked away. Please, go on. It took me a couple of hours to drive back to Saxby-on-Avon. I'd been busy at the shop. I remember that it was exactly 7:30 when I arrived. I looked at my watch. But the thing is, Mr. Punt, once I got there, I had second thoughts. I wasn't sure I did want to see him after all. I didn't want to be humiliated. I sat in the car for about an hour before I decided that since I'd come all this way, I might as well give it a try. It must have been about 8:30 when I drove to the house. I parked in my usual spot behind the lodge. I suppose that was force of habit. Someone else had had the same idea. There was a bicycle leaning against the door. I remembered that later. Maybe I should have read more into it at the time. Anyway, I walked up the drive. It was all coming back to me, being there again. The lake was on my left, and I couldn't bring myself to look at it. The moon was out that night, and everything in the garden was crystal clear, like in a photograph. There didn't seem to be anyone else around. I didn't try to hide myself or anything like that. I just walked straight up to the front door and rang the bell. I could see lights on behind the windows on the ground floor, so I guessed Sir Magnus must be in. And sure enough, a minute or two later, he opened the door. I'll never forget the sight of him, Mr. Punt. The last time I'd seen him had been over 10 years ago when I moved out of the lodge. He was bigger than I remembered, fatter, certainly. He seemed to fill the doorway. He was wearing a suit and a tie, bright colors. He was holding a cigar. It took him a moment or two to recognize me, but then he smiled. "You," that's all he said. He spat the word at me. He wasn't exactly hostile, but he was surprised. And there was something else. He still had that strange smile on his face, like he was amused. "What do you want?" "I'd like to talk to you, if I may, Sir Magnus," I said. "It's about Mary." He looked back over his shoulder, and that was when I realized he wasn't alone. "I can't see you now," he said. "I just need a few minutes of your time. It's out of the question. Not now. You should have called before you came here. What time of the night do you think this is?" "Please, no. Come back tomorrow." He was about to close the door on me. I could see that. But then, at the last minute, he stopped and he asked me one last question. I'll never forget it. "Do you really think I killed your bloody dog?" he asked. "The dog?" Punt looked puzzled. "I should have told you, when we first moved to Pye Hall, we had a dog. Its name was Bella."
"Yes, that's right. It was a crossbreed, half Labrador, half Collie. I got her for Tom, for his 10th birthday, and Sir Magnus was against her from the day she arrived. He didn't want her out of control on his lawn, scaring the chickens. He didn't want her digging up the flower beds. Actually, I'll tell you what he didn't want. He didn't want me buying a present for my own son. It's like what I was saying. He wanted to have complete control over me and my family, and because the dog was connected to me, the one thing I bought that Tom really loved, he had to get rid of it."
"He killed it?" Fraser asked. He remembered the sad little collar that Punt had found in the room at the lodge house. "I was never able to prove it was him. Maybe he got Brent to do it for him. I wouldn't put it past that snivelling little bastard. But one day the dog was there, and the next day it had vanished. And it wasn't until a week later that we found it in Dingle Dell, with its throat cut." Tom was devastated. It was the first thing he'd ever had in his life that was really his. Who could do that to a little boy?
"It seems very strange," Punt muttered. "Sir Magnus has not seen you for many years. You turn up unexpectedly at his house late in the night. Why do you think he chooses this moment to ask you about the dog?"
"I have no idea."
"What did you say to him?"
"I didn't know what to say. But it didn't matter anyway, because right then he closed the door. He shut it right in my face. A man who'd lost his wife not 2 weeks before. He wasn't prepared even to invite me over the threshold. That was the sort of person he was."
There was a long silence. "The conversation that you have described," Punt muttered, "how close was it, do you think, to the reality? Were those exactly the words used by Sir Magnus?"
"As best as I can remember, Mr. Punt."
"He did not, for example, greet you by name? He knew who I was, if that's what you mean. But no, it was just that single word, you, as if I'd crawled out from under some stone."
"What did you do next?"
"What could I do? I went back to my car and drove off."
"The bicycle that you had seen, was it still there?"
"I can't remember, to be honest. I didn't look."
"So you left?"
"I was angry. I'd driven a long way, and I hadn't expected to be dismissed out of hand. I got about 10 or 15 miles down the road, and then, you know what? I changed my mind. I was still thinking of Robert. I was still thinking of what was right. And who was bloody Magnus Pye to slam the door in my face? That man had been pushing me around since the day I'd met him, and suddenly I'd had enough. I drove back to Pye Hall, and this time I didn't stop at the lodge. I drove right up to the front door, got out, and rang the bell again. You had been away for how long? 20 minutes? 25? I didn't look at my watch. I didn't care about the time. I was just determined to have it out. Only this time, Sir Magnus didn't come to the door. I rang twice more. Nothing. So I opened the letterbox and knelt down, meaning to shout at him. I was going to tell him he was a bloody coward and that he should come to the door. Blakiston broke off. That was when I saw him. There was so much blood I couldn't miss him. He was lying in the hallway right in front of my eyes. I didn't realize then that his head had been lopped off. The body was facing away from me, thank God, but I knew at once that he was dead. There could be no doubt of it. I was shocked. More than that, I was poleaxed. It was like I'd been punched in the face. I felt myself falling, and I thought I was going to faint. Somehow I managed to get back to my feet. I knew that someone had killed Sir Magnus in the last 20 minutes. In the time that I'd left and come back again. Perhaps they'd been with him when I'd knocked the first time. They could actually have been listening to me inside the hallway. Maybe they waited until I'd gone and killed him then. Blakiston lit another cigarette. His hand was shaking. I know what you're going to ask, Mr. Punt. Why didn't I go to the police? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? I was the last person to see him alive, and at the same time, I had every reason to want him dead. I'd lost my son, and I blamed Sir Magnus. I'd lost my wife, and she was working for him, too. That man has been like the devil at the feast, and if the police are looking for a suspect, they won't need to look any further than me. I didn't kill him, but I knew straight away what they'd think, and all I wanted to do was to get the hell out of there. I picked myself up and got back in the car, and I drove away as fast as I could. Another car arrived just as I passed through the gate. I didn't see anything, just a pair of headlights, but I was afraid that whoever was driving would have got my number plate and reported me. Was that what happened? It was Lady Pye in the car, Punt told him. She had just returned from London. Well, I'm sorry I had to leave her to it. It must have been horrible for her. But all I wanted to do was get away. That was my only thought. Mr. Blakiston, do you have any idea who may have been in the house with Sir Magnus Pye when you visited? How could I possibly know? I didn't hear anyone. I didn't see anyone. Could it have been a woman? Curiously, that was my thought. If he was having a secret assignation, or whatever you might want to call it, he might have behaved the same way. Are you aware that your son is amongst the suspects who are believed to have killed Sir Magnus? Robert? Why, that's madness. He had no reason to kill him. In fact, I've told you, he always looked up to Sir Magnus. The two of them were thick as thieves. But he has precisely the same motivation as yourself. He could have held Sir Magnus responsible for the death of both his brother and his mother. Punt raised a hand before Blakiston could answer. I just find it puzzling that you did not come forward with the information that you have given me now. You say that you did not kill him, and yet by remaining silent, you have allowed the real killer to remain undetected. The matter of the bicycle, for example, is of great importance. Maybe I should have come forward, Blakiston replied. But I knew it would go badly for me, like it always has. The truth of it is, I wish I'd never gone near the place. Sometimes you read books about houses that have a curse. I've always thought that was a lot of nonsense, but I'd believe it about Pye Hall. It killed my wife and my child, and if you tell the police what I've told you, I'll probably end up being hanged. He smiled mirthlessly. And then it will have killed me. Chapter 2 Punt barely spoke on the way back, and James Fraser knew better than to interrupt his thoughts. He handled the Vauxhall expertly, pushing through the various gear changes and holding the middle of the road as the sun set and the shadows closed in on all sides. It was the only time he ever felt completely in control when he was behind the wheel. They had taken the Aust ferry across the River Severn, sitting together in silence as the Welsh coast slipped away behind them. Fraser was hungry. He'd had nothing to eat since the morning. They sold sandwiches on the ferry, but they were none too appetizing, and anyway, Punt didn't like food in the car. They reached the other side and drove through the Gloucester countryside, the same route that Blakiston would have taken to see Sir Magnus Pye. Fraser hoped to be in Saxby-on-Avon by 7 o'clock, in time for dinner. Eventually they reached Bath and began to follow the road that would bring them to Pye Hall, with the valley, now quite dark, stretching out on their left. Gold. Punt hadn't spoken for so long that Fraser started, hearing his voice. I'm sorry? He asked. The fool's gold, concealed by Sir Magnus Pye. I am convinced that everything revolves around it. But fool's gold isn't worth anything. Not to you, James, not to me. That is exactly the point. It killed Tom Blakiston. He tried to get it out of the lake. Ah, yes. The lake, you know, has been a dark presence in this tale, as in the stories of King Arthur. The children played beside the lake. One of them died in the lake, and Sir Magnus's silver, that too was concealed in the lake. You know, Punt, you're not making a lot of sense. I think of King Arthur and dragons and witches. In this story there was a witch and a dragon and a curse that could not be lifted. I take it you know who did it. I know everything, James. I had only to make the connections, and it all became very clear. Sometimes, you know, it is not the physical clues that lead to the solution of the crime. The words spoken by the vicar at a funeral, or a scrap of paper burned in a fire. They suggest one thing, but then they lead to quite another. The room that is locked at the lodge house. Why was it locked? We think we have the answer, but a moment's thought will assure us we are wrong. The letter addressed to Sir Magnus. We know who wrote it, we know why, but again, we are misled. We have to think. It is all conjecture, but soon we see that there can be no other way. Did Matthew Blakiston help you? Matthew Blakiston told me everything I need to know. It was he who started all this. Really? What did he do? He killed his wife.
Crouch End, London. Annoying, isn't it? I got to the end of the manuscript on Sunday afternoon and rang Charles Clover immediately. Charles is my boss, the CEO of Cloverleaf Books, publishers of the Atticus Punt series. My call went straight to voicemail. Charles, I said. What happened to the last chapter? What exactly is the point of giving me a whodunit to read when it doesn't actually say who did it? Can you call me back? I went down to the kitchen. There were two empty bottles of white wine in the bedroom and tortilla crumbs on the duvet. I knew I'd been indoors too long, but it was still cold and damp outside, and I couldn't be bothered to go out. There was nothing decent to drink in the house, so I opened a bottle of Rookie that Andreas had brought back from his last trip to Crete, poured myself a glass, and threw it back. It tasted like all foreign spirits do after they pass through Heathrow. Wrong. I'd brought the manuscript down with me, and I went through it again, trying to work out how much might be missing. The last section would have been called A Secret Never to Be Told, which was certainly appropriate, given the circumstances. Since Punt had announced that he'd already worked out the solution, it could only have had two or maybe three sections. Presumably, he would gather the suspects, tell them the truth, make an arrest, then go home and die. I knew that Alan Conway had wanted to end the series for a while, but it had still come as an unpleasant surprise to find that he had done exactly that. The brain tumour struck me as a slightly unoriginal way to dispatch his main character, but it was also unarguable, which I suppose is why he had chosen it. I have to admit that if I shed a tear, it was more for our future sales figures. So who killed Sir Magnus Pye? I had nothing better to do, so I drew out a pad of paper and a pen and sat down in the kitchen with the typescript beside me. It even occurred to me that Charles might have done this on purpose, to test me. He'd be in the office when I got there on Monday. He was always the first to arrive. And he'd ask for a solution before he gave me the final pages. Charles does have a strange sense of humour. I've often seen him chuckling at jokes that nobody else in the room is aware that he's made. Number one, Neville Brent, the groundsman. He's the most obvious suspect. First of all, he dislikes Mary Blakiston and has just been fired by Sir Magnus Pye. He has a simple, clear-cut reason to do away with both of them. Also, he's connected to all the deaths. He's there at the house when Mary dies, and he's virtually the last person to see Sir Magnus alive. Supposedly, he goes straight to the ferryman when he finishes work on the night of the death. But Conway throws in a strange detail on page 77. Brent reaches the pub 25 minutes later. Why is he so specific about the time? It may be an extraneous detail, and it may even be wrong. Let's not forget we're dealing with a first draft here. But I was under the impression that the ferryman was only 10 minutes away from Pye Hall, and the extra 15 minutes might have given Brent time to double back, to slip in through the back door while Sir Magnus was talking to Matthew Blakiston, and to kill him immediately afterwards. There's something else about Brent. It's almost certain that he's a paedophile. He was a solitary man, unmarried, definitely peculiar. A certain smell lingered in the air, the smell of a man living alone. The police find Boy Scout magazines on his bedroom floor, and quite casually, on page 176, we're told that he was once caught spying on scouts who were camping in Dingle Dell. These details leapt out at me, because by and large, there's so little sex in the Atticus Punt novels. Although it's worth remembering that the killer in Gin and Cyanide turns out to be gay. She poisons her lesbian partner. Did Brent have an unhealthy interest in the two boys, Tom and Robert Blakiston? It's surely no coincidence that he is the one who discovers Tom Blakiston when he's drowned in the lake. I even wonder about the deaths of his mother and father, supposedly in a motor accident. And finally, he was probably the one who killed the dog. All of which said, it is the first law of whodunits that the most likely suspect never turns out to be the killer. So I suppose that rules him out. Number two, Robert Blakiston, the car mechanic. Robert is also linked to all three deaths. In his own way, he's as weird as Brent. He has pale skin and an awkward haircut. He never got on with the other children at school. He was arrested in Bristol, and most pertinently, he has a difficult relationship with his mother that culminates with a public row in which he more or less threatens to kill her. I'm cheating here, but speaking as an editor, it would also be quite satisfying if Robert were the murderer, as Joyce Anderling only goes to Punt because she's trying to protect him. I can easily imagine a last chapter in which her hopes are destroyed when her fiancé is unmasked. That's the solution I would have chosen. However, there are two major problems with this theory. The first is that unless Joyce Anderling was lying, Robert couldn't possibly have killed his mother because the two of them were in bed together at the time it occurred. It's probably true that the pink motor scooter would have been noticed as it whizzed down to Pye Hall at 9 o'clock in the morning, although it doesn't seem to have stopped the killer from using the vicar's squeaky bicycle at 9 o'clock at night. More significantly, though, and Punt mentions this on at least one occasion, Robert doesn't seem to have any motive for killing Sir Magnus, who has only ever been kind to him. Could he have blamed Sir Magnus for the death of his younger brother when they were playing at the lake? He had, after all, supplied the fool's gold that had caused the tragedy. And Robert was the second person to arrive on the scene, plunging into the water to help drag his brother out. He must have been traumatized. Could he even have blamed him for the death of his mother? Maybe Robert is my number one suspect after all, and Brent my second. I don't know. Number three, Robin Osborne, the vicar. Alan Conway has a habit of playing a minor card at the end of the game. In No Rest for the Wicked, for example, Agnes Carmichael, who turns out to be the killer, hasn't spoken a word. Hardly surprising, as she's a deaf mute. I don't think Osborne kills Sir Magnus because of Dingle Dell, nor do I think that he kills Mary Blakiston because of whatever it was that she found on his desk. But it's certainly interesting that his bicycle has been used during the second crime. Could he really have been in the church all that time? And on page 98, Henrietta notices a bloodstain on her husband's sleeve. This isn't mentioned again, but I'm sure that Conway would have got to it in the missing pages. I'm also interested in the holiday that Osborne took with his wife in Devonshire. Certainly he's reluctant to talk about it when Punt questions him. The vicar seemed nonplussed, and refuses to give even the name of the hotel. I may be reading too much into it, but Brent's parents also died in Devonshire. Is this in some way connected? Number four, Matthew Blakiston, the father. Really, he should be at the top of my list, as we are told quite unequivocally that he murdered his wife. Punt says so at the end of part six. He killed his wife. And it is inconceivable that he's lying. In all eight books, even when he makes a mistake, the false arrest in Atticus Punt's Christmas, which infuriated readers who felt that Conway hadn't played fair, he has never been less than 100% honest. If he announces that Matthew Blakiston killed his wife, then that is what happened. Although annoyingly, he doesn't say why. Nor, for that matter, does he explain how he came to this conclusion. The explanation, of course, will be contained in the missing chapter. Did Matthew also kill Sir Magnus? I don't think so. I've managed to work out at least one detail. The handprint in the flowerbed was left by Blakiston when he was looking through the letterbox. I felt myself falling, and I thought I was going to faint. These are his own words. He must have stretched out his hand to steady himself and left the print in the soft earth. He kills his wife and for some reason returns to the scene of the crime. If this is the case, then, as unlikely as it sounds, there's a second killer in Saxby-on-Avon who deals with Sir Magnus for a quite different reason. Number five, Clarissa Pye, the sister. Sometimes, when I read a whodunit, I get a feeling about someone for no particularly good reason. And that's the case here. Clarissa had every reason to hate her brother and might have intended to kill both Lady Pye and her son Freddy in order to inherit Pye Hall. The whole story about stealing the physostigmine to commit suicide could have been a lie and would also explain the need to do away with Mary Blakiston. And let's not forget that Clarissa had a key to the front door of Pye Hall. It's mentioned once on page 62, though not again. There's also the case of Dr. Renard and the twins exchanged at birth. When did Clarissa discover the truth? Was it really when Dr. Redwing told her? I only ask this because there's an odd reference to Ashton House, where Dr. Renard lives, on page 6. In his funeral address, the vicar mentions that Mary Blakiston was a regular visitor there. It could be that Renard had told her what had happened, and she, being the sort of person she was, had then told Clarissa. That would give Clarissa a compelling reason to kill both Mary and Sir Magnus. The physostigmine could have been for Lady Pye and Freddy. It could even be that Dr. Renard's fall hadn't actually been an accident, although perhaps I'm taking this too far. I dismiss the Whiteheads, Dr. Redwing and her artist husband, Francis Pye, and the slightly improbable Jack Dartford. They all had motives for the murder of Sir Magnus, but I couldn't see any reason why any of them would have wanted to harm Mary Blakiston. That just left Joy Sandling, the least likely suspect of them all. But why would she have wanted to kill anyone? And more to the point, Why would she have gone to Atticus Punt in the first place? Anyway, that was how I spent Sunday afternoon, leafing through the manuscript, making notes, and really getting nowhere. That evening, I met a couple of friends at the BFI for a screening of The Maltese Falcon, but I wasn't able to focus on the labyrinthine plot. I was thinking about Magnus and Mary and bloody scraps of paper, dead dogs, and letters in wrong envelopes. I wondered why the manuscript was incomplete, and I was annoyed that Charles hadn't called me back. Later that night, I found out why. I treated myself to a taxi, and the driver had the radio on. It was the fourth item on the evening news. Alan Conway was dead. Cloverleaf Books. My name is Susan Ryland, and I am the head of fiction at Cloverleaf Books. The role isn't as grand as it sounds, as there are only 15 of us and a dog in the building, and we produce no more than 20 books a year. I work on about half of them. For such a small operation, we don't have a bad list. There are a couple of well-respected authors who have won literary awards, a best-selling fantasy writer, and a children's author who has just been announced as the new laureate. We can't afford the production costs of cookery books, but in the past we've done well with travel guides, self-help, and biographies. But the simple truth is that Alan Conway was by far our biggest name, and our entire business plan depended on the success of Magpie Murders. The company was set up 11 years ago by Charles Clover, who is well known throughout the industry, and I'd been with him from the start. We were together at Orion when he decided to branch out on his own, working out of a building that he'd bought near the British Museum. The look of the place absolutely suited him. Three floors, narrow corridors, worn carpets, wooden panels, not much daylight. At a time when everyone else was nervously embracing the 21st century, the publishers are generally not the first off the line when it comes to social or technological change. He was quite happy in his role as a throwback. Well, he had worked with Graham Greene, Anthony Burgess, and Muriel Spark. There's even a photograph of him having dinner with a very elderly Noel Coward, although he always says that he was so drunk he can't remember the name of the restaurant, nor a single word that the great man said. Charles and I spend so much time together that people assume we must once have been lovers, although we never were. He's married with two grown-up children, one of whom, Laura, is about to give birth to his first grandchild. He lives in the rather grand double-fronted house in Parsons Green that he and his wife Elaine have owned for 30 years. I've been there for dinner a few times, and the evenings have always been marked by interesting company, really good wine, and conversation that goes on late into the night. That said, he doesn't tend to socialize much outside the office, at least not with people from the world of publishing. He reads a great deal. He plays the cello. I've heard it said that he took a lot of drugs when he was in his teens and early 20s, but you wouldn't believe it looking at him now. I hadn't actually seen him for a week. I'd been on the road with an author from Tuesday to Friday. We'd had events in Birmingham, Manchester, Edinburgh and Dublin, along with radio and newspaper interviews. It had gone surprisingly well. When I'd come in late on Friday afternoon, he'd already left for the weekend. The typescript of Magpie Murders had been waiting for me on my desk. It occurred to me, as I threw my bag down and flicked on my computer the following Monday, that he and I must have read it at the same time, and that, after all, he couldn't have known it was incomplete when he left it for me. He was already in his office, which was on the first floor at the opposite end of the corridor to mine. He looked out onto the main road, New Oxford Street and Bloomsbury Way. My part of the building was quieter. He had an elegant square room with three windows, bookshelves, of course, and a surprising number of trophies on display. Charles doesn't actually like award ceremonies. He thinks of them as a necessary evil. But over the years, Cloverleaf has managed to win quite a few of them. Nibbies, Gold Daggers, IPG Awards, and somehow they found their way here. It was all very neat. Charles liked to know where everything was, and he had a secretary, Jemima, who looked after him. although she didn't seem to be around. He was sitting behind his desk, with his own copy of Magpie Murders in front of him. I saw that he'd been making notes in the margin, using a fountain pen filled with red ink. I must describe Charles as he was